pressing down a special key, it plays a little melody.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of our hundreds of past programs at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to promote public understanding of and support for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. Radio In Vivo is proud to acknowledge the underwriting support of our friend Mr. Steve Brockman. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by Steve for the advancement of science and education. And it's also a great pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob and Elena Condor at Carolina Neuropsychological Service in Raleigh. They specialize in assessing and treating brain disorders. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Chapel Hill Eye Care, located at 235 South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill Eye Care provides comprehensive eye care to people of all ages. Healthy eyes for a lifetime. Chapel Hill Eye Care, 919-968-4774. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Well, every so often, I have the pleasure of welcoming guests to this show who are both important members of the scientific community here in the Triangle and personal friends as well. That certainly is the case this week, as I am joined by an old friend and a new friend, both of whom I consider to be colleagues as well. We are going to explore the world of science communication, particularly in the forum of American Scientist, the magazine of Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Society, which has its headquarters out on Highway 54, right here in the heart of Research Triangle Park. Fenella Saunders is the managing editor of American Scientist, where she has been on staff since 2005. She was previously a science writer and editor for the New York University School of Medicine's Publications Office and associate editor of their magazine, NYU Physician. Additionally, Fenella spent 8 years at Discover Magazine, where she was an associate editor and online editor. And she received an AB degree in computer science from good old Duke University and a master's in psychology and animal behavior from Hunter College of the City University of New York. Dr. Jamie Vernon joined American Scientist and Sigma Psi just this past July. He is director of science communications and publications at Sigma Psi and also holds the position of editor-in-chief for American Scientist magazine. He came to Sigma Xi after serving as an American Association for the Advancement of Science, Science and Technology Policy Fellow, and an Oak Ridge Institute for Science and Education Fellow say all that three times fast, at the U.S. Department of Energy, where he developed strategies to measure and communicate the impacts of the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy's R&D investments. Jamie has written for Scientific American and was formerly a regular contributor to Chris Mooney's The Intersection, a blog at Discover Magazine. And he became a member of Sigma Xi in 2013 and served on a panel at the 2013 annual meeting about science communication in the 21st century. And joining the Sigma Xi team in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, represents a homecoming for Jamie and his family, including his wife and two daughters and two pugs. Because prior to completing his PhD in cell and molecular biology at the University of Texas at Austin, he earned an MS in molecular biology and biotechnology from East Carolina University and a BS in zoology from North Carolina State University. Well, Jamie and Fenella, thanks for joining me today on Radio In Vivo.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
It's great to see you as always, Ernie.
Now, I'm going to let you guys talk for a while. That was a long introduction. For our listeners who may not be familiar with your magazine or your organization, and there's probably a few out there, I'd like to take a few moments to provide some background and history for both. So, Jamie, why don't we start with you and start with Sigma Xi itself. The society has a very long and distinguished record. What can you give us a quick overview of the society?
Sure. So thank you again for allowing us to talk about Sigma Xi today. I'm really excited to talk about American Scientist, but the organization is really the backer to publishing the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And Sigma Xi is over 100, almost 130 years now. It started in 1886 at Cornell University. It was originally intended to be an organization that acted as an honor society for scientists from all different disciplines. It was really the brain idea, the concept of Frank Van Vleck, a mechanical engineering professor at Cornell, who was thinking about Phi Beta Kappa as sort of a organization that represents all disciplines of academia, and he thought there deserved to be something related to science. So he started this organization then. It's gone on to grow up to 150,000 members. We have 500 chapters, university chapters across the country. Our mission is to enhance the health of the research enterprise, foster integrity in science and engineering, and promote the public's understanding of science for the purpose of improving the human condition. So that's a lot for us to accomplish.
Sure.
We do it in a variety of ways, providing grants to researchers, publishing the magazine for public understanding of science. We have programs on ethics and human rights. And so we do a variety of different activities to meet those goals.
You're also a grant-making organization, aren't you?
Exactly, yeah. We have small grants for researchers up to $1,000 in all disciplines, and then we have NSF funding for up to $5,000 for astronomy research and small $2,500 for vision-related research.
I see. And when was the current headquarters building, which is so impressive, mm-hmm. out there in RTP, when was that built and occupied?
Yeah, so Sigma Xi was originally at Cornell, then it moved to Yale in the 70s, American Scientist as well. And then in the late 80s, 89, the Sigma Xi decided they were going to move to North Carolina. They chose RTP area, and they started to think about what the new headquarters was going to look like. They planned early. It took until about 2003 for them to break ground on the new building, and by 2004 they were in the new building with the American Scientist staff coming along.
I see. Mm-hmm. And do you think the society will continue to reside in the building?
Oh, yeah. This is a great source of pride for the organization. We have a wall of honor that is marble carved to memorialize all of the Nobel laureates. We have over 200 Nobel laureate members, mm-hmm. including Albert Einstein. And
I was going to ask you about it, because if anyone ever goes to that right. building, that wall is mm-hmm. quite impressive. It's quite a sight.
It's a great sight, yeah.
Yeah, and Lasker and some of the others are on there, aren't
That's
they?
That's right.
Tell us also a little bit, Jamie, about the 125th anniversary, mm-hmm. which occurred in 2011.
Right. So the organization at 125th anniversary was was really an opportunity for us to look back at what we've accomplished and think about where we wanted the organization to go. Obviously, over the years, Sigma Xi has acted as an honor society, but taken on a variety of different roles in the scientific community, funding, and so there started to be this revisitation of what the organization means to science and research, and we now are a much broader organization since that period. But that was a moment of pride. 125 years, the organization was launched when Coca-Cola sold its first product as a headache remedy. We were launched when Mercedes-Benz got its first patent. Avon started when we started Johnson & Johnson. So we've been following those major products and corporations, and so we've been along for a big, interesting ride.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you were involved with Sigma Xi well before your employment, right?
Shortly before. I followed Sigma Xi for a very long time, but I actually was inducted as a member in 2013.
Which we should not pass over that. That's quite an honor, actually.
Right. It is such an honor because scientists become members through nominations. It requires nomination, and you have to go through a review process, and once you're accepted, you're a member for life.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's really great. Well, Jamie, what can you tell us about the Sigma Xi aspect of your new job as Director of Science Communications and Publications?
Yeah, so I think about this, obviously I have to think about this a lot, and what science communications means to Sigma Xi, and we do it in a variety of ways. I really look at science communication in two ways. There's science about, or communication about science, and then there's communication for science. And really what I'm saying there is you've got a culture of scientists understanding how to do their jobs, how to share experiences in finding grants, how to find jobs. That's communicating about the science culture and what scientists do. And then communication of science is really the actual science, the products that come out of the lab, the discoveries. Mm-hmm. And so because I work for Sigma Xi specifically, I have to cover all of that. And so for our members, we want to offer those conversations. What does it mean to be a scientist? How do you become a successful scientist? And conveying that through our various channels, which we can talk about a little bit more, but including blogs and social media, and then having American scientists speak to that occasionally, but really American scientists serving as the communication of science. And that's where my role as the editor-in-chief becomes more important. It's allowing scientists to present their work, the discoveries, directly to the public, as well as to share it in a way that's entertaining and engaging for other scientists in different disciplines.
Makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. Well, Jamie, before we pass on to talking about American scientists and letting Fenella actually speak, we'll get to you in just a minute, Fenella.
She can't wait.
I wanted to ask you also, we shouldn't go any further without recognizing the fact that just since you've been on board, Sigma Xi has launched a new publication with a really interesting and unique approach called The Chronicle of the New Researcher. Tell us more about that venture.
This is a very exciting venture. The Chronicle is really targeted towards pre-collegiate researchers. So high school students who are actually doing unique and independent work have the opportunity now to publish with The Chronicle of the New Researcher. And this is actually a partnership. We've brought on DirecTV to help us fund this effort. And it's been a great partnership because what they're actually going to do is provide a platform for these scientists, these young scientists, to get their work to a broader public. And the idea there is that young scientists getting to the experience of writing a manuscript very early in their careers not only gets them recognition, but also gives them the skills that they're going to need immediately upon arriving at grad school and will carry through to their longer scientific research careers. So I'm very excited about this. We're partnering with the individual chapters across the country. We're now looking out to how we can mentor young high schoolers, how we can partner with high schools that are local to our various chapters and get those manuscripts that really impress us. And we've already published three now, and we're reviewing several in the pipeline, so they'll be coming out. And this is all done online.
It's all online, yes. So there's no print edition of that one.
No.
But who needs primaries?
Right, yeah, not in this world.
We will actually get to that question, Fenella. Yeah, yeah. I've got one prepared for you right. on that.
Sure.
Well, Fenella, let's bring you into the discussion.
Sure,
better late
I'd love
than
to.
Never.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit more about American Scientist, particularly, you know, starting maybe with the history of it.
Sure, yeah.
Because it's such a distinguished history.
Well, yeah, we actually recently celebrated our centennial as well in 2012. So the magazine's been around for a little bit over 100 years now. And it was actually started it was started as a publication for Sigma Xi. It was originally called Sigma Xi Quarterly.
Oh, okay.
And it was designed initially to increase notice of the society, and at that time, obviously, nobody had the internet in, you know, 1913. So it was the way that the society was able to sort of get more recognition for their activities.
So it was almost like a newsletter in those days.
It was though, a lot right? like a newsletter okay. in those days. It was not initially designed as sort of a professional journal or anything like that.
I see.
But in the sort of the late 30s and early 40s, that was when there was a shift to adding more about actual research reports. There were initially reports about presentations and things that had happened at meetings and other things that there was a demand for people to have a record of those things. So it was transformed into a more of a professional journal and renamed as American Scientist in 1942.
Mm-hmm. That's such a long way back and
right.
such a distinguished
right.
History.
And there's been a lot of change since then, obviously.
I would assume so.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
obviously not a static publication. Mm-hmm. We actually didn't move to sort of the magazine format until 1970.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So at that point it went, and there was actually a lot of debate about this because the initial size of the journal was designed to fit in a lab coat pocket.
Ah,
and
okay.
so when they moved to a magazine format, there was a lot of contention about the fact that it no longer did fit in the lab coat pocket.
Right.
But that allowed us to become a lot more of a modern, current magazine. That was when the magazine started to have color illustrations. We started running Sidney Harris cartoons at that time as well. So it became much more of a popular magazine at that point.
I see. Well, fill us in on some of the basics about the magazine today. How often do you publish, and what is the format?
So the magazine is published every other month, bimonthly. And we publish about an 80-page issue every other month. And we have features that are sort of more in-depth that cover the gamut of areas in science. We try to have a good mix because Sigma Xi is such a multidisciplinary organization. We want to have something that appeals to everybody in each issue. And we have a really marvelous art staff. And so we do a lot of custom illustrations where we work directly with the scientists in order to produce things that really haven't ever existed before to illustrate their research. So that's a very mm-hmm. strong point about what we do now. And we also have a number of regular departments that we have. We have a perspective department, which gives a little bit more of like an opinion piece about some area of science. We have a technologue column that covers things that are more techie
mm-hmm.
in various areas, everything from biotech through robotics. And we have some regulars that have been with us for a long time. You know, Brian Hayes writes our computing science column.
Right.
And that one we love. It's very unique in that Brian writes a lot of his own original code to explain lots of different areas you might not think computing science relates to. But he actually describes some really amazing things, you know, things like analyzing historical literature, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
it really runs the gamut. And we have Henry Potosky, who writes for us about engineering in each issue as well. And we recently started a column called Arts Lab, where we talk about some areas of the artistic world that draw inspiration from science. So, and we've had a long-standing column called Sightings, which is much more about the visualization of science. So those are both complementary articles, because Sightings is more about how you make science visually accessible, where Arts Lab is more about how you actually draw inspiration for science for sort of a larger purpose of artistic expression.
I see. And we should also not neglect the long tradition of scientific book reviews as
yes,
well.
Yes, yes. We've had a long time a scientist bookshelf that was a large section of the magazine. We now do something called Scientist Nightstand, but we also have an e-newsletter that we send out, which has a lot more information about books that have come out and various reviews that are accessible on the internet.
Okay. Well, Jimmy, let's bring you back in, both of you, either whoever wants to field this, but it's really, the American scientist is really kind of a unique cross between a scientific journal and a general interest magazine, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's interesting that we're able to cover and present science in a way that gives scientists the opportunity to connect it to a broader set of issues, a little more relevant to an average citizen's perspective than what you're going to get with a journal. And so we really value the opportunity that we offer scientists to speak directly to readers in a way that allows them some creativity to use our art department, our illustrators, to present graphs or images in ways that they could only imagine doing in our pages versus what they're limited to doing in a more academic journal. It's a great experience for the reader as well as the scientist.
Mm-hmm. And just, Fenella, what is the circulation of the magazine?
It depends if you're talking about circulation or readership. I mean, we're talking around 100,000, depending on for people who pick up the magazine at libraries in various places like
that
as well.
Okay. So yeah, that must make for quite a lively ongoing conversation, I would think.
Yeah, definitely. We definitely have a lot of people who are very passionate about science who we recently on our website implemented a system called Discuss, which is a sort of a general commentary system that's used on a lot of different websites. So that makes it a lot more accessible and easier for people to actually leave comments on our website. You don't have to have a specific login for our website in order to leave comments.
I see. That's very interesting. Well, Fenella, I'm curious about the editorial process here. What is that about in working with an author who is typically a working scientist, a lab rat, as it were, typically? What is it like working with those people to perfect an article?
Well, it's obviously very dependent on the individual scientist, but in general, we try to make the process as collaborative as possible. A lot of scientists have never written for a popular audience before. Some of them pick up on it very quickly. Others need more help. But the idea is that we try to work with them right from the beginning. Once we, most of our articles are actually invited, so we actually do a lot of the legwork of going out and finding out who's sort of the big people in the field doing the big work that should be in the magazine.
So you're anticipating my next question.
Oh, I'm
Angela.
Sorry.
That's okay.
But once we approach them, we don't sort of leave them on their own. We want to make sure that we work with them all the way through the process. So we actually read a lot of their papers and have a discussion with them first to talk about shaping and framing of the article, because although our features are fairly long, there's still a limited amount of space. So
sure.
We want our articles to kind of have an overarching feel. A lot of our articles are designed to give a little bit more background and overview of an area, as well as talk about a researcher's individual experience within that field. So we sort of have to work with scientists to give them that framework. And once we work with them on that, we'll go back and forth. We'll often talk about outlines before they even start writing. Mm-hmm. We'll go over partial drafts to give them feedback. We work with them right up through the whole process. It takes months, depending on the time frame. Some scientists are slower than others because, they're very busy and they've got a lot of other things to do. I often point out some examples. We had an article a few months ago. It was very popularly received about quantum randomness, and that one had been invited about 4.5 years before it actually came in. So we keep up with people for a long time. We're very persistent.
Them,
yeah,
right?
We're very persistent.
Well, I had to ask. It sounds like it could be a potentially hair-raising experience, and without naming any names, can you relate some of your war stories in your experience as an editor?
Sure. It's just one of those things where you really have to develop a lot of diplomatic skills when you're working with
I'll
scientists.
Bet.
And but to us, it's really worth it because I have to say, we really feel like it's part of our mission not to just pick the low-hanging fruit. We want to make sure that we're talking to the scientists who are doing good work, who really might not be good communicators, but who have really interesting stories to tell if you can help them kind of tease that out. So we often go after people who don't really know anything about science communication just because we feel like you know, these are important stories. So we're more interested in the story than worrying about, you know, how hard the process is going to be. But I mean, there are people who are resistant to it. I've had a number of scientists who don't understand the concept of an introduction and a conclusion. We have a chronic problem that people often let their prose just kind of fall off a cliff at the end, where it just suddenly ends and you're like, okay, where are we going from here? So I've probably written more conclusions than anything else in my career as an editor. And then also just kind of helping people ease into articles, introductions, how you actually set things up, background information, things like that. And but the really to us, the way that we handle it is to always invoke the reader. So we take the reader's side, and we want to make sure that the scientist is thinking about things from the reader's perspective. You know, I am not the one that the scientist is trying to write for. So it's got nothing to do with me. It's not personal.
Sure.
So I will always say to the scientist, you know, from the reader's perspective, this is what is going to make sense. So that's how we kind of approach it. And actually, most people are pretty receptive to that kind of approach, because it takes them out of themselves and really makes them understand why we're making the changes that we make. But you do sometimes, with some scientists, you have to be very specific about why you're asking them to make specific changes, because they don't think about things the same way as sometimes other people do.
That's true. And they are more used to the manuscript type of writing, where the demands are completely different.
Mm-hmm. That's very true.
Yeah. So how are the graphics and photos added, and what is that process like? Because, Jamie, as you mentioned, a lot of times the content won't come with the visuals.
Right.
Well, I guess I'll speak a little to that on as far as what the process is, and then Fenella can elaborate on the actual process of developing the art.
And not to interrupt, but I should add that is really one of the great strengths of American Scientist. It's a visual treat always.
And it's something that we win a lot of awards for as well.
I'll bet. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, we're definitely, our art department performs beautifully every month or every issue. And so we really start out with the article. Initially, we have our art meetings. We have some brainstorming sessions. We have each of the editors who've had conversations with the scientists, having thought through to some degree what might be the visuals associated. And oftentimes you will get from the authors some very academic type of presentations of data, or in health articles, you know, the health images that you've seen with the black band over someone's eyes or over a part that you don't want them to see.
Post for a few of those.
Right. And so what we obviously want to make those types of visualizations more engaging for the readers and more pleasant experience. And so our art department, Barbara Alessino and Tom Dunn, are phenomenal at looking at an image and just coming up with either an illustration or some digital presentation that makes it much more appealing to the readers. And beyond that, then the editors will take it back to the authors, the scientists, and they'll present them on various stages of development. And we arrive at the beautiful images you see in the pages very close to the end of the process before we ship.
I see. I'll bet the scientists themselves, the authors, I'll bet they're just tickled at that part of it.
I think it's actually one of the bigger draws in writing for the magazine in a way. Scientists just don't always have the opportunity to work directly with really talented artists to present the ideas that they have. And sometimes, you know, our artists come up with presentation ideas that they've never even thought of, or present things in ways that are very different than what they could do on their own. So, and those materials we allow them to reuse in their presentations and things like that. So it's actually kind of a big draw for our authorship, along with everything else that's involved with, you know, being in the magazine itself.
Sure. Do they ever come with pretty good visuals themselves?
Sometimes, you know, there's always cases where somebody will come in with very clearly thought out ideas. But, you know, they don't always have access to people who have just that artistic ability. I mean, there's very few places. I worked with one author last year who was very high up at a medical institution, and they did have a graphics department. He was able to just work with that graphics department to really develop some really interesting graphics that were custom for his piece. But that's very rare. I mean, most institutions don't employ artists. So,
right. And there's another element, too. There is existing art that represents some of the concepts that are covered in the articles, and so we will look around and see what's available, what's out there. We'll identify artists and see if we can adapt their images or adapt existing art or photos to the magazine, and in that way, our artists or our art department's able to even do more because they can access a broader community. So we then treat those with as freelancers or, you know, other external artists.
I see. Yeah. Very good.
I do have to say, though, that one of the really fun things about the artwork in the magazine is when we have the opportunity to create things that just don't exist anywhere else at all. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, I have to give one example where I worked with our contributing art director, Tom Dunn. We were doing an article on Rorqual whales, which are the whales that dive and, you know, it's baleen whales that's filter feed, and they have this big chest pouch that puffs out as they fill it up with water when they dive very deeply. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of question about the formation of the tongue inside the mouth as they dove down, because a whale diving hundreds of feet in the ocean, you obviously cannot physically see what happens to the tongue. And so we worked directly with the author and did some of our own research and were able to develop something that basically showed that for the first time in any kind of illustration about what actually happens. And it's really quite fascinating. You know, they have a gigantic tongue to begin with, but it stretches out and actually fills the bottom of the oral cavity as they dive down and sort of acts as a buffer to stop the water from going down through the throat while they're actually doing the filter feeding. So it was really quite astounding.
That sounds really neat. Yeah. And what a thrill to create something like that, as you say, for
right.
the first time.
And as a teaser for our upcoming issue, Tom is actually sitting around dissecting hydrangea plants so that we can have some accurate anatomical drawings of the insides of hydrangea flowers. So
excellent.
Something to look forward to in the
oh
next
boy.
Issue.
Well, Finella, why don't you walk us a little bit through the current issue, the September-October 2014 issue, which is out on your newsstands now, as they say.
Right.
Just give us a quick sample of what's in this issue, just so our listeners get a feel for the types of articles.
Right. Well, we actually have a really interesting cover on this issue that I should probably mention first.
Sure.
We have an artist called Greg Dunn, who is a neuroscientist by training, but was trying to incorporate some of his training into his artwork. And he's actually used tenets taken from Asian scroll paintings and ink drawings to represent neurons and in an artistic but also scientifically accurate way. So mm-hmm. that's our latest Arts Lab column, which is really fun. And we also have a really interesting feature about a reptile called the tuatara, which is native to New Zealand. And it's this really sort of ancient, long-lived reptile. But it's almost like the canary in the coal mine, but for climate change, because this organism doesn't have genes that determine sex. Sex is determined by temperature. So as the mm-hmm. temperature rises, they're actually getting a higher percentage of male offspring. So there's a question about how you actually conserve and what you can do when a species is threatened in a way that you can't really control. Because eventually, you know, especially in certain subpopulations, they could be all male and obviously not viable breeding populations. We also have a really interesting feature going up into space about the radiation belts that surround the Earth. And there was some information that came out recently about a giant solar storm that almost hit the Earth in 2012 and how it was a very near miss.
Sure.
And one of the researchers involved in that research actually wrote this article for us.
Nice.
And this is somebody who actually trained with Van Allen, who the belts are named after, and was the first person to put up the probes that first discovered these belts in sort of the late 50s. So this is all about some new research they found about just how dynamic these radiation belts are and how solar storms impact them and what happens to them when they sort of get injected with this radiation energy from solar storms, and how that could really have an impact on satellites that are in orbit and things that could happen to them and, you know, possible threats to modern society, because, you know, we're all very dependent on those right now.
Yeah.
But there's also potential threats to regular power systems on Earth. You know, there have been blackouts in the past because solar storms have impacted on the Earth and caused overloads of power stations. But mm-hmm. in this day and age, it would be much more catastrophic. So understanding how these belts work is actually very important to the entirety of modern society, even though it's sort of this invisible thing we never see.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like a great feature for sure.
Right.
And I'm sure there's a lot more. Issue is really action-packed, it seems like.
Right, yeah.
And one of the things I wanted to ask both of you to comment on was just how you managed to maintain such a lively mix of content and disciplines. Mm-hmm. Every single issue has something for everybody, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's the beauty and the art of American Scientist magazine in itself, is that it was originally intended to connect scientists from various disciplines and allow them to speak to one another. So that was the original design for the magazine. And that's continued over all these years, that we have ensured or guaranteed that you're going to hear from various disciplines. And so that's built into the DNA of the magazine, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it's a process of maintaining constant monitoring of review articles, of what's happening at meetings. We send our editors to a variety of different meetings, from health to conservation to astronomy. We also tap into a broader network. We ask our members to provide recommendations. We have direct submissions. And so we get that opportunity to look at all of the different disciplines and choose what the best of the best that we're going to put in the pages of American Scientist.
And it really reflects the personality of Sigma Xi itself, doesn't it?
Exactly. It's part of the mission, and it absolutely is the personality of the organization.
I just have to say that I have to give a lot of recognition here to our other editors that are on staff, because we definitely try to keep a mix of people on staff that have various disciplines and various expertise. We have a lot of people on staff that have been doing this for a very long time and who have built up
names.
Well, our associate editor's name is Katie Burke. Mm-hmm. She has a PhD in ecology. And so she covers a lot of our areas. She did the Tuatara article that I was mentioning before.
Sure.
So she covers a lot of those areas, as well as other areas in science and medicine. And we also have a senior editor named Sandra Ackerman, who has a background in neuroscience. So she covers a lot of our medical and brain issues as well. So we try to just maintain a staff that has knowledge and built up understanding in so many different fields. It's really one of those things that you have to have a lot of years of expertise in order to really understand where things are going and what the big stories are.
Sure. My guests on Radio In Vivo today are Fenella Saunders and Jamie Vernon from American Scientist magazine and Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Society. Well, Fenella and Jamie, I'd like both of you to comment on some of the more recent activities associated with American Scientist and the Society, I take it, that are reflective of the times and the current media landscape, starting with our good old pizza lunches and podcasts.
So this is something that we've been holding at American Scientist for over a decade, and something that other organizations such as Science Communicators of North Carolina, which Ernie's involved in, so he helps
Indeed.
Us with these. But also we get funding from the NC Biotech Center and from the RTP chapter of Sigma Xi sponsors these events as well. So we bring in various science communicators from all over the area to give talks that are aimed both at just the regular public as well as science communicators. Gives us a chance to get some live connection and between scientists and a broader audience, which again is part of our mission. In recent years, I'd say the past 5 years or so, we've been recording these talks. And so in some way, we've been producing some kind of podcast. We used to record the entire talk. Now we do more of a shorter interview that's produced and incorporates some of the information from the talk to produce a podcast, which is available on our website.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really been a great resource for us to not only have a closer connection to people in our community who are doing tremendous research, really, but we also have the opportunity sometimes to bring in people from the outside or to interview visiting scholars. So we've expanded the global scope, even just doing local interviews.
Yeah, absolutely. And since I've been involved, I've been so impressed with the flavor of the audiences that come. It typically seems mm-hmm. about 40 or 50 people.
Right. And we really get the gamut of ages, too, which is also really fun. We have everybody mm-hmm. from high school students through retired professors coming to these things. So you could see anybody from 16 to 80 there. And I really enjoy having the crossover between those different generations and just having people have that as a sense of community where they can meet other people in the area who have a similar interest to them. It's really fun funny. At one point, we had a pizza lunch one time where two scientists were actually meeting up there to collaborate on something. And they said, do you mind if we just hang out and talk after the pizza lunch? I said, no, this is fantastic. You know, you guys feel free. So it's really fostering a sense of community and collaboration as well as getting information out there.
I see. Well, and there's also a trend towards web-only materials I've been noticing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about The Chronicle, which is an online publication. But in general, there's obviously this growing revolution of science communication online, which involves all social media blogs and that. It's been happening for a decade at least in real earnest. But we have, in recent days, on the American Scientist, really expanded what we're doing digitally. We're trying to do more interviews. We do more Google Hangouts. Last year's annual meeting was about science communication in the 21st century. We had a panel of folks, including myself and Bethany Berkshire and Danielle Lee, very prominent online personalities, to talk about what science communication looks like in the 21st century and how we can use technology to do that. And so we've ramped up our social media presence. We're currently in the process of looking at our website and how we're going to modify that, modernize that, take advantage of some of the trends that we're observing, and how we can bring that to American Scientists to create a digital reading experience. I think there's something special and unique about having the print and being able to sit down in your comfortable chair and read these articles under your own light, and that's something that not everyone can do online, and so we definitely want to keep that too.
That was my next question, actually, because the other major scientific publication that comes out of the RTP is Environmental Health Perspectives, which is the monthly journal of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, and they dropped print publication and became an online-only journal in January of 2013. Mm-hmm. So the trend kind of seems to be, going in that direction. And I wondered if there was any thought at American Scientists to doing that. But before you answer, let me just weigh in, because I totally agree with you. Yeah. I love having the physical object and being able to curl up in the recliner, and that glossy cover and the great artwork really comes out better in print than, I mean, we spend all our time looking at screens. It's great to have that print experience still.
Right. The print is very important to Sigma Xi, to the members. A lot of the majority of our subscriptions come through our membership. And so those members want to be able to have American Scientists sitting on their desk, and whenever they want to sit down and pick up a story, they want to have that opportunity. So we want to keep that, and in the short term, we're not envisioning any elimination of the print. That seems to be just such a point of joy for our members. Long term, we really aren't expecting to phase out print, but we're exploring all options, and we are going to expand our digital presence.
Sure.
And we intend to have the digital have a new look online, and that may carry over to what we're continuing to do in print. And so I don't anticipate losing print. I love it. And I think that our members do as well, our subscribers. And knowing that we anticipate expanding on the newsstands as well with some of the new changes, content changes that we'll be bringing in the future, I expect that print will be around for quite a while for us. A lot of people are revisiting this the decisions they've made. So,
Well, I'm glad to hear your thoughts on that, because as I've expressed, I totally support that. Well, Fenella and Jamie, I'd like to spend some of our remaining time together, kind of expanding the conversation and talking about science writing and science communication. Areas that you are both intimately involved with on a daily basis and at a very high level. Either one of you, feel free to jump in. How would you say science writing has changed over, say, the last 20 years or so?
I think you should start. Go ahead.
Oh. Well, I guess in a variety of ways, you really have the traditional manuscript, the journals that were all the primary ways of sharing science in the past, and then in the news, papers, and even online with the news organizations, there was somewhat journalistic coverage of science with a fair amount of vigor. But in recent years, the science departments have been phased out of a lot of the large news organizations. And what has actually happened is this growth in independent science communications. And so a lot of that has also brought in an informality to the types of communications that's happening in the sense of a blog versus a traditional news article. We're seeing tremendous changes. We're bringing a lot more personality and personal experience to the communication of science. I think that it's part of a broader effort to sort of connect science to the public in a way, largely because scientists know that the science landscape is changing, funding, the views from the public is changing, and it's important for the public to understand the benefits of science. Mm-hmm. So in addition to communicating the very scholarly science to scientists and who are looking for the most recent discoveries, you've got the public who wants to know, why are we putting so much investment through our tax dollars in science? And so there's a lot of this conversation of the importance of science and what it does in modern life and trying to connect it to the broader community. I think that we're currently undergoing a trend right now that is revisiting long-form science communication in the sense of organizations like Atavist and Mosaic, and these are websites that are allowing science journalists or science communicators of a variety of sorts to write longer form about science with a much more investigational voice. And so it's broadened over the last 20 years, I would say. It's become a little more informal, and it's taking on there's a sense of urgency, especially around issues like climate change, where the scientists feel like we've got to have a voice out there to make the case for taking action. And so there's a variety of different changes that have happened.
Sure. Fenella, anything to add to that?
I would just say that I also think that there's been a lot of blurring of the medium by which science is communicated. It used to be that you could be a straight print journalist for your entire career, and that's just not something that happens anymore. There's so much mixing that happens now. So, you know, if you have an article, you also have a multimedia piece that goes along with it. Maybe you've got an audio interview that goes with it. So it's much more of a package. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to take that approach when you're communicating science, where you can't just think of it as one individual piece. You have to think of it as an entire experience that you're going to be presenting to a reader/viewer. So that you're not just capturing one aspect of the discussion, you're trying to give them a full picture.
I see. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, do you think that scientists themselves are becoming more skilled communicators? I mean, you work directly with scientists every day. Or do you think they're at least beginning to recognize the value of communicating their science to the wider public? Because I know this has been an ongoing issue for years in the scientific community, and it seems like every meeting I go to, somebody's talking about that.
It's a big debate, actually. I think there are a lot of scientists who are interested in broader communication, and many of them are lucky that they have the venue to do so, but some of them are still being stymied in a lot of ways by the institutions where they are, because their leadership at that institution doesn't see that as a valuable thing. They say, well, why are you doing this? This is taking away from your time doing other things that are really important. Mm-hmm. So they sort of have this push me, pull you kind of attitude there, where they're trying to say, look, you know, this is important. We need to get our message out there. And there are some institutions that have just sort of not caught up with the modern times in that way. And I think that will change. But right now, it's still one of the things that's debated within the scientists community about what's really worth our time to do in terms of career advancement.
Sure, sure. Yeah,
I would say that's true. And
there's and even the publication imperative.
That's right.
You know, plays in to a certain extent.
Right. There's been exponential growth in publishing of in scientific journals, but also with incentives or motivations like the NSF funding requirements that include broader impacts. I think scientists have realized that when NSF is asking for them to delineate what their broader impacts are, it involves communication to the public, because really it's about making the science relevant to the public. And with that level of federal influence, it necessitates a science communication, either training or practice of some sort and improvement. And in some cases, the scientists who do choose to become better communicators have an opportunity to increase their funding based simply on broader impacts types of work. And so, yes, I would say scientists, there's a community of scientists, particularly the younger community, and I think that part of what Fenella cited as the institutional resistance to science communication is a generational challenge. Mm-hmm. I think the young scientists recognize that it's important to make their science relevant, and they're trying to do it. And in many cases, there are organizations who are now trying to develop the new graduate training programs that incorporate science communication into that, partly because there's been this interest in creating alternate career paths for scientists if they choose to get a PhD but don't necessarily want to stay into the academic track, sure. Then they can go out and do things with it, and science communication is a great place to do that.
I'm seeing more and more young people following that kind of path and you know, not spending all their time in the lab.
That's right.
But it's sort of interesting that the blog platform has allowed young scientists to get a foothold in that area without having to completely commit to dropping their scientific research. There's ways that they can do both now. Mm-hmm, and I mm-hmm. think that that's important because it doesn't make people make a choice. And they're sure. still able to get a foot in that door without mm-hmm. having to stop what they're doing.
And do you think they're becoming more open and enthusiastic about working with folks like us who bring translational skills to the table?
Absolutely. I think they're looking for that. Those who are interested are looking for opportunities to engage with professionals to learn more and more. There are programs across the country. I'll cite one that's organized by Compass. The Aldo Leopold Fellowship trains scientists to engage with journalists and how to get their stories in the hands of the journalists and make sure that it's accurate to the best of the journalistic capability, mm-hmm. and really gets the message out there. And so there is definitely a trend. It may be more than a trend. This may be what the new normal is, that scientists engage in science communication with professionals.
Sure. Well, Fenella, earlier this year, you wrote an editorial in the magazine that I wanted to ask you about. Called The Science of Narrative, which I found quite intriguing, the way you put it, in which you were presenting two articles in that issue that called for more recognition of the importance of narrative in presenting scientific information. Would you fill us in a little bit more on that?
Right, yeah, that actually was a letter from the editors that we wrote to kind of frame two of the articles we had in that issue, which had to do with sort of two sides of the same coin from different perspectives about narrative in science writing. One was from a regular contributor of ours named Roald Hoffman, who writes our perspective piece a couple of times a year. And his complaint was that he felt that narrative discussions sort of excluded science and said that science doesn't have a narrative. And in his feeling, you know, he could read a science paper and if it was written well, he could understand a lot of the drama that had happened in the discovery and see how sort of the main characters of the discovery or the scientists had unfolded. So to him, it was more sort of a complaint that narratology didn't recognize science writing as a piece of it. And then the flip side of that, we had an article in our arts lab by Robert Louis Chianese, who is also a regular contributor for our column, mm-hmm. where he was saying that there were certain stories in science that could benefit from using language from other places, such as poetry, and in some ways that would be more descriptive and more factual than just describing events. So the point of the articles, and I think the larger point that we all try to get to, is that there are multiple perspectives on how narrative should be done, and it was more to just launch that discussion into the idea of, you know, science writing doesn't have to be a monolith. It can have many different aspects and many different sort of flavors to it.
Does that also apply, do you think, to the more formal manuscript type, you know, scholarly journal type writing?
Well, I have to say that, you know, I've seen over the years the stuff that makes the cover of Nature, for instance, is usually articles that are written in a more accessible style. So there may not be any, you know, hard data to support it, but I have a feeling that probably the editors of Nature are paying as much attention to readability as anybody else is, and other journals as well, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think every scientist needs to be aware of how important story and narrative are to effectively communicating your science?
Yeah, I think it depends on what you're really trying to achieve with the science. With the science communication, depending on your audience, obviously narrative becomes more important. And I find that among scientists, they don't necessarily need to get an emotional connection to the story. They want the facts, and that's the best way to communicate to among scientists what they've discovered or their most recent results. And so it really comes down to who are you talking with or to, and what are you trying to accomplish? That's when the narrative element becomes more important.
I see. Well, you know, one of the things I've noticed in the years of doing this show is that inevitably, no matter what the discipline, no matter who the scientist is, there's a passion there. And there are a lot of eureka moments out there that are just fascinating to get that person to open up about and let that passion flow through. Now, that's inappropriate in some contexts in scientific writing, but in bringing the narrative form in, it seems like that would be kind of a kernel of what's going on with that.
Right, and I also think that this is one of those cases where scientists can kind of, again, look at the sort of the larger package of writing that they can do. Maybe the scientific paper isn't the most appropriate place for them to talk about all their eureka moments or all their process, but if they can write a blog post to go with it that explains, you know, some of their findings that or their sort of interesting tidbits that might be interesting to other scientists, where they can say, look, this wasn't really worth publishing about, but here's something we found that's really interesting. Here's a piece of process that you might not discover on your own. I think they can start looking at their publications more as a package rather than just a single paper.
And I think you're going to see that more and more from American scientists, actually, as we move into the digital world with a much larger footprint. You're going to see that we have greater opportunities to allow scientists to explore in that way.
Well, Jamie and Fenella, we are flat out of time, and it's been such a treat having you on Radio In Vivo today. Keep up the great work at American Scientist and Sigma Xi, because you both exemplify those proud traditions.
Thank you very much, Ernie.
Thank you so much, Ernie. It's been great being here.
We've got some great guests lined up here on Radio In Vivo in the coming weeks. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows. And we are on Facebook, so we invite you to become a fan and stay up to date. And join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carborough and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we ask that you please make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time.